You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 4th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, we got a lot to talk about. Matthew Cortland will be joining us. He's a senior fellow at Data for Progress to discuss the supplemental security income legislative and restorative efforts. Meanwhile, Louis Rossman, founder of the Rossman Repair Group, also a YouTuber on the right to repair, most recently in Joe Biden's executive order to deal with antitrust. Meanwhile, Andrew Cuomo, found by the New York State Attorney General of sexual harassment, breaching federal and state law on multiple occasions with up to 11 women. Calls for Cuomo's resignation reach the White House, and calls for impeachment throughout the New York Assembly. Good news, Biden administration extends the moratorium on evictions for 60 days, what amounts to a huge win for Cori Bush, the squad, progressives, and millions of renters. On the other hand, Nina Turner loses her special election congressional bid in Ohio's 11th district yesterday. Trumpista won in the other Ohio special election. Back in Washington, the Senate nears that pivotal 60-vote threshold to finally end outstanding Iraq war authorizations, reaching back almost 30 years. And with people scrambling now, worried about schooling in the fall with the Delta variant, the FDA looks to give Pfizer's vaccine final non-emergency approval within a month. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. I'm here, as always, with Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
Quite a day. We have a lot to talk about. Some of it is... some of it's a bummer. Some of it's very positive. We're going to talk about the Nina Turner race and try and get a sense of what's going on with that in the second half of the show. But we will get there. Obviously, that is a huge disappointment for the left. On the other hand, we have some great news. And, you know, yesterday we were talking about Cori Bush, one of the newest members of the House. Probably, I mean, you know, as new as any member of the House. Let's put it that way.
One of the newest members of the squad.
She is the newest member of the squad, or one of the newer ones. Again, one of the newest, right?
Yeah,
a couple came in.
Yeah, she came in with Mondaire Jones. And
I don't think Mondaire Jones is specifically a member of the squad.
Okay, well, Jamal Bowman's a member of the squad. Jamal Bowman. I mean, we're semantics here, fella.
Well, indeed. And but it's all we do is we talk on the show.
Anyway, that's true. That's accurate.
Cori Bush literally camped out on the steps of the Capitol over the weekend to highlight the plight of potentially millions of Americans who are going to get evicted with the ending of the CDC eviction moratorium. The CDC issued this because it was a health requirement The Supreme Court had looked at it about a month ago, said, we don't think this is constitutional. We're going to let it but it's expiring in a month. So we'll be okay with that, letting it expire. The Biden administration seemed to do nothing regarding it. It's unclear whether they even thought about it. Apparently, internally, they thought about extending it, but they were worried that if it went back to the Supreme Court, there might be some, other impact on other programs, or there might be a ruling that might inhibit the government's ability to do stuff in health emergencies in the future. The Biden administration threw it to Congress 2 days before they were about to leave the House. Nancy Pelosi, having received, and who knows if there's a direct correlation here, I don't know, but it's just one of the facts, a huge donation to her PAC from a massive real estate mogul. But nevertheless, I think everybody agreed there was no time for the House at that point to take it up. And there was a sense of like the White House had no plan. Cori Bush got out there. She whipped up public sentiment and a public outcry on the left. And it brought us to Joe Biden making this announcement at the White House yesterday about that moratorium that they were going to extend it 60 days. But however, let's play that clip.
Is about to announce a new partial eviction moratorium, COVID-related. Can you tell us any more about that? And are you sure it's going to pass Supreme Court muster?
The answer is twofold. One, I've sought out constitutional scholars to determine what is the best possibility that would come from executive action or the CDC's judgment. What could they do that was most likely to pass muster constitutionally? The bulk of the constitutional scholarship says that it's not likely to pass constitutional muster, number one. But there are several key scholars who think that it may, and it's worth the effort. But the present, you could not, the court's already ruled on the present eviction moratorium. So I think what you're going to see, and I want to make it clear. I told you I would not tell the Justice Department or the medical experts, the scientists, what they should say or do. So I don't want to get ahead. The CDC has to make this. I asked the CDC to go back and consider other options that may be available to them. You're going to hear from them what those other options are. I have been informed they're about to make a judgment as the potential other options. Whether that option will pass constitutional measure with this administration, I can't tell you. I don't know. There are a few scholars who say it will, and others who say it's not likely to. But at a minimum, by the time it gets litigated, it will probably give some additional time while we're getting that $45 billion out to people who are, in fact, behind in the rent and don't have the money. That's why it was.
That last point's the key point. But I mean, like, the problem with outsourcing all of this to scholars, which, you know, is seemingly his go-to, is that when you're not making your own case and you're making it about, oh, does this pass constitutional muster? You're completely muddying the waters politically for what you're trying to do. And two, like, I don't necessarily know what kicking the can to constitutional scholars does. It's just, well, these people who are arguing over whether or not this very heavily politicized Supreme Court is going to side with you. Who cares? Who cares?
Well, that is,
the last point is the first and only point that he should be making.
I mean, I think as a political matter, I would agree with you. However, the one of the other elements of this is that it is going to go to the Supreme Court. And you do want to, I mean, the sad fact is, and this is a reality that people have to start to sort of like, I think, like, you know, internalize. This is a 6-3 conservative court. They are hostile, very hostile court. They are incredibly politicized. And I think what he's doing with that constitutional scholar, and I think like the accurate thing is not whether this is constitutional or not. That's not really the question. The question is it would the Supreme Court allow it to pass? And that's the real issue there. And so he's got to sort of tiptoe through this a little bit, because I think his audience there is the Supreme Court. He's going to let the progressives celebrate this and politicize it and make it and make some hay of it. But at the end of the day, who ultimately cares? The real issue here was mitigate the suffering of millions of people. And if this works, the 60 days gets them that rent relief, then, you know, all the power to Joe Biden. That's why they had to pretend like we had to let it go run out, because we have a new situation. It's a second thing, so maybe the court will look at it differently. That's all kabuki, and I'm convinced it's all for Justice Kavanaugh. And that's just the world we live in. But we have more to talk about this, but we got to take a quick break. We'll be back with Matthew Cortland in just a moment. Got to race through this a little bit, folks. This is a good one. Emma, you'll appreciate this. As you know, summer's here, and living with swamp ass is not easy.
Why is it as you know?
Yes, as you know. Well, as you know, because I've said that so many times now. How do you deal with it? Well, you try a refreshing spray from a Hello Tushy bidet. You'll keep yourself clean and fresh all summer long with the brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment. It is stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install, and it even saves you money. Look, folks, I think everybody knows. I get a little embarrassed reading these. This is not my wheelhouse, as it were. But the product is really great. I got the very bidet curious at one point over the COVID. These guys showed up coincidentally after Kyle had said, you know, he had gotten a bidet. I was like, I'm not going to spend thousands of dollars to get a bidet. And these guys showed up, and it was a godsend. It attaches to your existing toilet. No electricity is needed. No extra plumbing needed. You cut your toilet paper use, and you start doing what people have been doing all around the world, which makes a lot more sense than the way that we do it in this country. I can tell you that. Well, I think in this country, actually, more and more people are doing it because of Hello Tushy. They have a 60-day risk-free guarantee. They have a 12-month warranty. And they have, like I say, millions of people have become happy Hello Tushy customers. Defeat your swampy ass. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. Also sponsoring the program today, ZipRecruiter. At ZipRecruiter.com/majority. We got Brendan through ZipRecruiter, and in some ways, we got Bradley through ZipRecruiter because we got Bradley through Brendan. It works that way. Electricity. You get on the right track, folks. According to Forbes, gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, we get stores all across the country who are starting to gear up to get back into business. There's pent-up demand. People are going to be hiring. You got to be hiring quick. How do you do this? Well, ZipRecruiter. It is the fastest, most the easiest, most organized way to do it. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. What happens is when you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 100 top job sites, gives you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes. They find qualified candidates for your open roles, and then they proactively present them to you. You can easily review recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which of course encourages them to apply faster. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J-O-R-I-T-Y. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. All right. And what is the sort of peak Sam Cedar show. If Michael was here, he would be relentlessly, loving this and mocking me about it. I want to welcome our first guest to the program, Matthew Cortland. He is a fellow at the Data for Progress, and he does work on a host of things, but here today to talk about supplemental security income through Social Security. Matthew, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you both for having me. Thank you for giving a damn about impoverished, disabled people in this country. I'm grateful. Not many folks do.
Well, I have long considered Social Security to be one of our greatest achievements as a nation, frankly, and one that I would have hoped would have, you know, be built on more over the course of the past 100 years that we've been living with, 90 years some odd. But what gets very little attention and has been in the crosshairs in a way that Social Security in some ways can't be. I mean, Bush tried it in 2005. They call it the third rail of politics. But Social Security disability, the supplemental insurance, has been something that is not as prominent and has been under attack. Tell us about the history of that attack.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, just this is a confusing area, and I think it's confusing by design to make it hard for people to understand. There are two different programs. There's SSDI, which is Social Security Disability Insurance, and that's the program that on your paycheck, when they're pulling out those Social Security taxes, you're earning work credits, it's called, towards a day when you're not able to work because of a disability, you draw from those funds that you've paid into the system. For folks who aren't able to pay into the system, I got sick when I was about 8 years old and I went to graduate school. I was able to do that. And then I got super sick. I hadn't earned any work credits. And the program for people like me is called SSI, or Supplemental Security Income. It's administered by the Social Security Administration. It's the other Social Security Disability Program. It's the one that has really been forgotten, except when it's being attacked by sort of Trumpian Republicans. During the Trump years, we saw targeting of folks on both programs, really. They had a proposal that was going to require folks to go through what I call these "Are You Still Disabled Enough" audits. The Social Security Administration says, give us all of your medical records, everything that you've got. We want to make sure that you haven't, this stuff gets real offensive real quick, so I've got to be careful how I talk about it, but that your cancer hasn't been miraculously cured, your inflammatory bowel disease hasn't been miraculously cured, that you're still a wheelchair user. They wanted to target folks for these reviews, these audits, as often as every year. And we're talking about folks who are also facing terminal illnesses. It was just the most ghoulish, offensive, Trumpian attack that you could imagine. And just to put this in context, the most that SSI will pay out to a disabled beneficiary is $794 a month. $794 a month. And that's not all. If you have more than $2,000 in savings as an individual, or $3,000 if you're married, you lose the program. If a friend or relative helps you out with either a place to stay or some, like a bag of groceries, you can lose up to a third of your benefit. A third of $794 a month just yanked away. If you get married to someone with more than $3,000 of assets, you lose SSI eligibility. If you happen to marry another SSI recipient, you don't get your $794 a month and they get their $794 a month. The feds take a quarter. You're married now, so you don't need as much money. Two disabled people living together, they don't need as much. They reduce the benefit. So it's just, SSI is a punishing sub-poverty existence that even as a lawyer who knows how to fight and who knows how to deal with these systems, my hand still shook in anxiety every time there was a letter from the Social Security Administration in my mailbox, because I knew this could be the day that they take away my $794 a month that is all you are allowed to live on. So the Trumpian sort of universe wanted to attack folks struggling to survive on that $794 a month. And that's the maximum, by the way. The average benefit is much closer to $580 a month. There are over 1 million kids, by the way, who also get SSI benefits, in the Trumpian sort of attack really focused on those kids.
I just want people to sort of, you know, stop and contemplate this asset rule, because it really is stunning. The idea that if you, I don't know how one would have, frankly, the ability to put away and save, even if you, but let's just assume for some whatever, like, you've figured out how to live on $700. You get the maximum benefit and you figured out how to live on $700 a month. It's not possible as an individual to live any type of, like, a life that we would expect people to be able to live in a civilized society. And you were to save, let's say, $90 a month. The idea that if you were to save up, you know, for 2 years and have $2,000, that you would then lose this money. I mean, how do even people make a transition if they were in a position to make a transition off that? It's impossible to do. You have no like opportunity for any type of backdrop. Now, we have also this type of asset thing on things like Medicaid as well in different states. That is an incredibly ghoulish. It's one thing to say, like, you can't have $1 million in a bank and do this, but it's another to say $2,000.
It's a poverty trap. You are exactly right. It is literally a poverty trap. The rules of the program force people to stay in poverty, unless you're going to love this, Sam. If you're really wealthy, if you're a millionaire or a billionaire and you have a disabled child, for example, you can hire a lawyer to draft special trust documents that allow them to get SSI benefits and have a big pot of money. If you have a lawyer, if you can pay tens of thousands of dollars for counsel and then pay a trustee. So it's a rigged system. Just, you know, every other system in this country seems like it's rigged. This one is too. But if you are trapped in poverty, the 99.99% of SSI recipients are not the children of billionaires and millionaires. They are trapped in poverty because of the rule set of this program. And what's amazing right now is, after a pandemic that disproportionately killed people in the disability community, Congress is finally, after decades, considering improving the program, improving SSI, making the benefit a bit more livable, so it's not so far below the federal poverty line, maybe increasing that asset limit. I'm gonna do my call to action. You can join us in this one. You can text SSI now, sign SSI now to 50409, which is a ResistBot link. Our dear friends at ResistBot have helped out with the letter campaign to Congress.
Say that one more time, because we're gonna put that in the podcast and the show description and the YouTube description. So just say it one more time slowly.
Yep, it's you're gonna text the word sign and then SSI now, all one word, SSINOW, to 50409.
So talk about the SSI Restoration Act then too, because, you know, what does this do? I know it's Raul Grijalva and someone who we're not necessarily flowery about on this program, Representative Slotkin, they're backing this. What would this do?
Yeah, there are actually a lot of folks now who are interested in SSI and improving SSI in the Hill. Ayanna Pressley has been a fierce champion. Representative Bowman has been a fierce champion. Senator Warren. I've spent the morning thinking about Virginia. Senator Warren, my senator from Massachusetts. Senator Sanders. There are a lot of folks now who on the Hill who are really paying attention and have for a long time to this this issue of improving SSI. So the SSI Restoration Act is this piece of legislation. It's on the shelf. It's ready to go. It can be part of budget reconciliation. Senator Schumer, I'm talking to you. It would do a bunch of good things. It would raise that $2,000 asset rule to something more reasonable, at least $10,000. So you can have some savings when the Texas utility company turns off the power and you're a disabled person trying to struggle, like figure out how you're going to get through the night. Maybe you have a little bit of savings so you can go to a motel and not die. Maybe you're in the Pacific Northwest and you need to buy more masks to get through fire season, right? Increasing that asset limit. It would also increase the, right now you're allowed to, these numbers haven't been updated since I think the 70s. You're allowed to earn like $20 a month before they start penalizing you. Those numbers would be indexed to inflation so that like that things cost more. They just do every year. That's what inflation is. In this program, the asset limits and the amount that you're allowed to earn before you're penalized haven't kept pace with inflation. So it would increase those numbers to be in line with inflation. It would get rid of that rule that says if someone helps you out with a bag of groceries, and I got to tell you, I've been there as an SSI beneficiary when the cupboard was empty and my last $3 went to the Medicaid copay, the $3.65 copay for the medication that keeps me alive, and I didn't have any food. It would change the rule that penalizes people who get some mutual aid. It would eliminate that rule completely, and the same thing with housing. It would also just increase the amount of the benefit, because right now it's $794 a month, which is about 75% of the federal poverty line. It is not even level with the federal poverty line. It is below the federal poverty line. So for the 8 million Americans who rely on SSI, it would be a huge deal. I've got to tell you, I know it doesn't seem like a lot of money, you know, jumping from 75% of the federal poverty line all the way up to 100% of the federal poverty line, but there were months that would have made my life a lot easier. I wouldn't have been worried about being houseless or not being able to buy the medications that literally keep me alive. So it's not a very expensive bill. We're not talking about a lot of money. There are about 8 million Americans who rely on this, and the SSI Restoration Act would, in very real, meaningful, and concrete ways, make their lives, the lives of those 8 million people, including about 1 million kids, less horrific. Just, it's a hellscape trying to survive on SSI and the SSI Restoration Act, which we can include in budget reconciliation. SSI can be fixed through budget reconciliation. SSDI can't, but SSI can. Senator Schumer, you've got a chance to improve the lives of 8 million Americans who are struggling to make it through the end of the month.
All right. Well, listen, Matthew, I know you have a heart out in literally 2 minutes, and I want to have you back on the show, you know, so we can talk about this a little bit more in depth. But, you know, the point is, folks can text, give it to us one more time. And I would include in that, we will also put in Chuck Schumer's number in the description so that people can call Chuck Schumer's office. It is sign SSI now to 50409. Call Chuck Schumer's office. Tell him to put into the reconciliation bill the SSI Restoration Act of 2021. Matthew, I wish we had more time. I know you had this hard out, and we will do this again.
I appreciate it. I have to go do the chronically ill American in a pandemic thing and wait on hold with doctors' offices and insurers. I deeply appreciate the show in your audience, and thank you.
All right. Well, I appreciate you too. And we will also put up your Twitter feed. People can follow you on Twitter as well.
Matt BC. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. All right. We're gonna hold on and see if we get Louis on today. Matthew had a hard out. Apologize for that. It was something that we couldn't avoid, but we will have him back on. Just got an IM. From somebody said that in California, and I'm trying to find it now, here it is. Sean from North California says, on a side note for the topic of the interview, the state of California sent out $600 checks to underprivileged residents. People on disability received that money, except for SSDI. It's not the same as we've been talking about here, SSI, except for SSDI recipients did not receive that money. I mean, or just contemplate the dynamic here. If you get help for people from people, you suddenly are not eligible for 3/4 of the poverty line assistance by the federal government. I mean, it is just stunning. And so text sign SSI now, as in sign the bill, SIGNSSI now to 50409. You can get involved in that way. Also, call Chuck Schumer. If Chuck Schumer's office happens to be listening today, make sure this is in the bill. Schumer's Manhattan office is 212-486-4430. So check it out. Do we have Louis? Matt? Okay. All right. So joining us now, take a little bit of a turn to, again, this is something that I think Michael would have made fun of me for, because I am also a little bit of a fix-it myself. Louis Rossman is the owner and founder of the Rossman Repair Group. He's got a YouTube channel, and it focuses on being able to fix your stuff, which the right to repair has become has sort of re-entered into the news in the wake of Joe Biden's executive order that he was going to ramp up antitrust things. Louis, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
First thing I want to say is, do you accept interns? Because I want to apply. I did a little bit of this back in the day with VCRs, and I occasionally have rehabbed a lot of our computers in this in our office. And I think it's fantastic that you're sort of helping people to empower people to do this.
Well, we actually started offering workshops in the store, and I'm trying to do them about two or three times a week where people can come by for 2 to 3 hours, use the soldering equipment, the microscope, and the hot air station, and they can bring in anything they want to fix. So last week, we had someone show up with a broken Xbox, a CB radio, a Garmin GPS. Some of it we fixed, some of it we didn't, but I like having people come in on their own time to just be able to use the lab equipment if they don't have any at home. And yeah, we are actually, it's not an internship, but we are actually allowing people to just come in from time to time with stuff that doesn't work at a lot of times and be able to use the equipment here to do their own fix. And if they can't figure it out, then one of us will work with them and try to see if we can figure it out so that they can learn something.
That's fantastic. All right. Well, now let's talk about it in terms of, you know, there's obviously environmental reasons why you do that. There's a whole host of reasons why you would do that. But let's talk about the ability to do that and how this sort of this idea of right to repair ends up becoming a real political economy question. What has happened to our ability, our right to repair these things?
I think over the past 30 years, there's been a really, really slow shift away from the open availability of schematics and documents and parts. And it's just been kind of this slow fade that we didn't really notice until it was too late. You know, as Steve Wozniak recently said, you know, with the machines that he worked on in the 70s and 80s, they came with thick books and manuals that had the schematics and everything that you needed. And if there was a chip or something that broke in it, you could just find a vendor and be able to purchase it. And now you fast forward to 2021, if you buy one of the latest MacBook Pros and it stops charging because the Texas Instruments charging chip stopped working, I can't go to Texas Instruments and buy that chip. I can't go to Newark or Mouser or DigiKey and buy that because they have a restriction. They have an exclusivity agreement that bars me from being able to get that chip. So you're stuck now going to Apple paying $1,000 to $2,000 for that repair, and you're also not going to get any of your data off of the machine, even if you do pay them for the repair because they don't offer it. So it's one of these areas where the manufacturer is not interested in offering component level repair, but they're also putting in active measures to ensure that other people can't do it. And that's where I've tried to raise the alarm on this and showcase on my channel. These are repairs that we're competent to do, we're able to do, that we're able to save people money. Here is the specific way in which the manufacturer is going out of their way to ensure that that can't happen. And in my opinion, it's wrong.
I mean, they're not just going out of their way. I mean, this is part of their business strategy, right? I mean, they are creating, I don't know if this would be defined as a, I guess it's a they're monopolizing, they're creating a monopsony on one end, and they're monopolizing the market for this. And it is one of those situations where it's not only, you know, costing consumers more, but it's also inhibiting people's ability to build, to have shops that might repair this stuff. I mean, it has inhibitions throughout our entire economy.
Yeah, and I would like to try and propose the argument that what's happening here is actually a tie. They're tying the purchase of a repair service to the purchase of that product from that company. If you are going to make the device difficult to repair, fine. That's not something that I have an issue with. But when they go out of their way to ensure that even basic components that used to just a few years ago be openly available, not be available for fixing basic problems, at that point you are kind of tying the repair of the device to purchasing the, you know, all of your services from that one company. Similar to what Kodak was doing in the late 80s and early 90s. And I hope to see the FTC start enforcing antitrust a little bit more here, which seems to be something that they've kind of fallen off the bandwagon with about over the last 5 to 10 years.
How much, I mean, has this been over the past 5 or 10 years? Or is this, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm coming at this from having, you know, talked to a lot of people about antitrust over the years. And I think there was a lot of people who were surprised that, you know, who don't pay attention to this stuff, who are surprised that Biden even made that an issue in his executive order. I mean, how much is your sense that there's a political movement out there that's associated with this? Or has this been just something that you've, like, you know, come across because this is what you're doing as an individual?
I came across this because this is what I do as an individual. But it wasn't until I started doing these YouTube videos and I started visiting legislatures that I started to realize that it's everywhere. When I went to Nebraska to lobby in behalf of this, I was in a room with a bunch of farmers. And I thought, why are a bunch of farmers in here for a right to repair bill? I had no idea that this was an issue that affected them. When I went to New York,
explain to us how that does. Because I don't think most people have that awareness either. Like, how does it affect farmers?
If they want to repair their tractor, very often for certain issues, they're stuck going to the dealer. And if you have to go to a dealer during, you know, let's say it's a crop season, again, I'm not a farmer, so this isn't my thing. So I may misstep here in some of my explanation. But from what I hear from them, if they need a repair done, they need it to be able to do it within the next 1 or 2 or 3 hours. They can't go to a dealer where they have to arrange a tow because the nearest dealer is 30 or 40 miles away. So not only are they stuck paying for a tow and they need a repair, but they're also stuck dealing with the dealership. A lot of the limitations I talk about when I talk about not being able to repair Apple products, there's a lot of similarity there to what a lot of tractor companies, particularly John Deere, do. And a lot of the people that showed up there had identical complaints to me. It's just you cross out the word MacBook and you put in the word tractor. But I mean, this is some.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. This is something where there were people in the medical industry fixing endoscopes that were showing up lobbying with me. There were people that wanted to be able to fix operating tables that were there saying, I can't get access to a $500 motor to a $30,000 operating table, and this is costing the hospital, you know, over $30,000. This is something that's showing up in home appliances. So I didn't really know that this was something that was endemic to every corner of society. But it's something that I've been learning over the past few years, and I think more people are waking up to it and realizing they have the same problem as people in sister industries.
What other industries are there? I mean, accepting that you have limitations, you may not, you know exactly the issue that a farmer is going to face in that situation. But what other, when you're going around, like you see to other places, like where else have you traveled to advocate for this? And what other industries have you come across that this dynamic exists?
I've done this in Maine, Massachusetts, New York, Nebraska, Tennessee, and Washington and Maryland. And I've seen people show up that do appliance repair, medical device repair, tractor repair, and consumer electronics repair, camera repair, car repair. So when I first started out at this, I just thought it's difficult to repair Apple products because the company makes it difficult. And what I found over the past few years is that this is something it's kind of a cultural shift that we've made to where people have not really noticed it. People have not really noticed that most items that they buy are less repairable. And it's not just because they're getting smaller or more technical or more complex. It's because there are active restrictions that the manufacturers are placing on people being able to fix their own stuff.
And again, to be clear with people, this is a form of monopoly. And the downstream impact of this, I think, is clear. As a business owner who's running a business, you know, trying to do a business, it's a problem for the individual consumer. It's a problem for startups. It's a problem. it also just makes people less, you know, it requires them to pay more money, you know, to get these things fixed, and all sorts of productivity in the case of the farmers. You know, you only get a certain amount of time where the crop is ready to be harvested, or you can get your seeds in the ground, or, you know, you don't want your hay ruined because it's raining, whatever it is. There's a clock on this. So give me a sense of, like, prior to Biden issuing this executive order, which, you know, we need to see the impact of it. But had there been any other organizations that you had come across when you were going to testify in these hearings? Were there broad movements that supported you? How did you end up getting there? Did you just someone write you and say, hey, you know, we're doing this here, you might want to come, or what?
My friend Jessa Jones is friends with Gay Gordon Byrne from Repair.org, and she said, you should come up and lobby with us. It'll be fun. But you're going to have to wear a tie. And we had an argument about wearing a tie for about a half hour, but I finally conceded. And we went up, and it was actually a lot of fun. And what got me hooked on it was when I went up to the New York State Legislature, there was this one gentleman there who said, when you repair a motherboard and you run a wire on it, or you replace this fuse or this chip, you're converting the MacBook into a PC and then misrepresenting it as a MacBook to your customers, and that's fraud. And this legislator that I talked to was at least 70 years old. He wasn't the most technically savvy. And I said, with all due respect, did you actually believe that? And he said, well, now I don't. And I said, why did you believe that? And he said, nobody showed up to tell me otherwise. But now, you know, now that you did, you got a signature, you got a co-sponsor for your bill. And he signed it. And I thought, this is amazing. So I like the fact that the only way that this has gotten this bad is because nobody else shows up. Everybody is so cynical and so jaded with the political system that this is the level of difficulty they're playing on. Like, that's easy difficulty. They show up, they make something up that is insane. I think my face was turning red when I heard this with anger, and I tried to contain it just because it was so ridiculous. And since nobody is showing up, they're able to get away with that kind of stuff. And I thought, okay, I'll be the person in the room. Like, if nobody else is showing up, I'm not a political advocate, I'm not a social person, I don't know how any of this works, but somebody's got to show up, so I'll show up. And then I started showing up all around the country every time one of these bills happened. And the first time I showed up at one of them, the testimony that I heard was just kind of really disingenuous and ridiculous. And I thought, people should really hear what these lobbyists are saying so that we can have some change. So I knew I wasn't going to get anywhere, you know, getting a bill passed that day. But I thought, let me just show up with my camera to show people what they're saying, that microwaves are going to explode, that phones are going to explode, that all this fear mongering. And that stuff really started to go viral online. People don't like listening to lobbyists lie to politicians to diminish their rights as a consumer.
So wait a second. So that 70-year-old lawmaker in New York State, he had been told this by lobbyists that you were essentially converting the Mac into a PC by soldering a certain part of the motherboard, and therefore you were misrepresenting. That's actually funny if it was. If it wasn't have such real world implications. And so this is basically and when you say one of these bills, you're talking about a right to repair bill.
Yeah, it's popped up in over 17 states across the country, and there are certain modifications for each individual state, but for the most part, all of them are based in the same template, which is almost a copy and paste of the Massachusetts Automotive Right to Repair Bill that passed in 2012.
I see. And is there a with the righttorepair.org folks, who are, you know, sort of ostensibly like sort of lobbying for the right to repair? Is there any sort of like broad strategy of, you know, if we allow for this right, let's say in New York State, which is a huge market, or maybe California, which is a huge market? I mean, we see this dynamic in the context of things like CAFE standards in California. You know, if California puts on some type of standards, it ends up becoming nationwide because it's just, more expensive to create cars for California separately than the rest of the country. Is there a dynamic like that there, or is it possible that you get a law passed? I mean, has a law passed in any of these states?
No, it gets shot down every time.
Okay, well, I guess that explains that. But were it to pass, let's say you already passed one in New York State, would we have a system where theoretically you can repair this if you're in New York, and Texas Instruments can sell you this if you're in New York? Or how do you get How do you get Texas Instruments, let's just say, and I'm just using Texas Instruments as an example. You brought them up. I don't know this dynamic, but Texas Instruments doesn't sell a certain transistor that you need for some electronic device. It can't because of their deal with Apple, let's just say. Again, I'm making this up. Would they, how do you get them to sell it to you even if they're not restricted by Apple?
Well, the way that this would work in this type of globalized world, you cannot be able to sell a chip to someone in New York without that chip making its way everywhere else. So I wouldn't ask Texas Instruments or even Apple to sell me a chip directly. I would simply ask that these things be made available. And typically, Texas Instruments would sell to a distributor that then sells to a site like Mouser or DigiKey or Newark that then would sell to a retail schlub like me that only wants to buy 100 or 1,000 or 5,000 at a time. So if you make it so that that is available in New York, it's even if you only made it available in New York or only made it available in Massachusetts or Nebraska or Tennessee, somebody in that state is going to put up a website that says, here are chips that we have for sale, and they're going to be made available worldwide. Or if a schematic is made available in New York or Tennessee, that's going to get put somewhere and that's going to get shared. There's no way that you can have this passed in one region of the world but not in other regions of the world. So at that point, they would have to decide, we're not going to sell to this state. Apple would have to decide that they are not going to want to sell MacBooks to a state, to two states with the most hipsters in the United States, or they're going to have to just stop being assholes. And what I would imagine would happen is they would stop being assholes. And that's what happened with the automotive right to repair bill in 2012. They're not even asking for the car to be designed differently in other states. They're just asking you to make this stuff available. And they just decided to make it available for every state and mechanics in every state rather than just Massachusetts.
Okay. So in the fallout for the 2012 Massachusetts bill, it ended up opening up all these markets.
Yeah, and the reason that this bill that we have is very much so based on the Massachusetts Automotive Right to Repair Bill is that you look at it 9 years later and there haven't been negative unintended consequences from it. So it's not like we're using a piece of radical, untested legislation. You know, cars are not blowing up that didn't blow up before. Mechanics are not, you know, stealing information from their customers and then showing up in their garages to beat them like the commercials were showing last year.
I just want to make sure that that's a cat that's attacking you and not like the specter of corporations who don't want this legislation to build.
Yes, this is Mr. Clinton. I had him on a T-shirt that said schematics or die or fight for right to repair 5 years ago. He's a strong supporter.
So give us a sense of like what's happening with this fight. Like, I mean, what was the response? You know, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we talk to people who are who are very political in nature, and this is, you know, you're coming at this from a different angle. It's literally you need to do this to you stumbled on this the political dynamic as, you know, a function of trying to fix your computers, essentially. What was the response within the community to Biden's announcement?
A lot of it was healthy skepticism because over the past 5 to 6 years, we've heard over and over again, we support what you're doing. Oh, I'll co-sponsor this bill, and something always winds up getting killed. So I'll be honest, there's just been a lot of healthy skepticism towards it. And for me, what I get out of this is that when I show up at a legislature, I don't have to hear, has the attorney general said anything about this? Has the FTC said anything about this? I no longer have to just twiddle my thumbs and say, now I can say the FTC released a 59-page report encouraging state legislatures to do something. In their report, they said that every excuse you've heard today from a lobbyist has no basis in evidence or fact, and Biden asked the FTC to look into creating rules. So now, the thing I've noticed about lots of legislators is that what pushes them to pass legislation is either or not pass it is A, that it will make their base happy, or B, a fear that they are going to have a rug pull moment when they pass a piece of legislation that is massively unpopular or unsupported. And a lot of the legislators I've spoke to, they hear my concerns and they, you know, they want to help, but they say, has anybody else spoken on this issue? Because they don't want to be the one that's, you know, sticking their neck out only to have it chopped off by getting in trouble with the federal government by passing something at the state level that they cannot enforce. And when Biden says, we're encouraging you to issue rules against anti-competitive restrictions on using independent repair shops, that really does put some wind under the wings of state legislators, and it may make them be a little bit less risk averse, which is going to be great when going up to lobby this session.
Have you I imagine there hasn't been an opportunity where you could test out that theory, because it's, you know, it is fascinating to see the implications of the president just up there and do something that doesn't have an immediate effect, but empowers people who are activists like yourself to push, you know, to lever, you know, basically gives you more leverage when you're going to do this. Have you been out there lobbying since that has occurred?
A lot of the states where these bills have been introduced have sessions that are going to be starting again in September or October. But I did get a call from the personal cell phone of a legislator I don't want to say the state because I don't want to get it. I don't want the opposition to get started just yet. But he called and he bragged and he said, you know, I pass more bills than anybody in the state, and I want to make this my project. Tell me how I can solve issue X, Y, and Z. And that was awesome. I had a 2-hour conversation with him. I have his personal cell phone number, and this really does seem to have gotten people to notice it. That this is something that if they stick their neck out, they're not going to get in trouble for it, and that a lot of people in there that are their voters would support. I am still going to be doing this across legislatures around the country. I'm not waiting for the FTC to do something, because if you look at this executive order, it covers non-competes, drug prices, internet bills, airline refunds, switching banks and taking your data, and meat processing. They have a lot of work to do. I'm not, you know, right to repair is in the list, and that's great, but there's a good chance of them not getting to it just with everything else they have on the list. So I am going to use this as leverage to try to get all of these state legislatures that have gone to it before that have said, I'm not really sure if we're going to get in trouble if we do this, and say, no, you're not. The FTC and the president both support you.
And to be clear, this legislation that you're pushing, the legislation you're pushing would have, like, is it, it happened for cars in Massachusetts, but would yours be more universal so that, let's say you pass a legislation in New York, it would help farmers? Well, there's a lot of farmers in New York, but farmers in Nebraska as well, with that same dynamic. In other words, would it be tractors? Would it be computers? Would it be cars? Would it be how is that legislation framed? Like, how broadly does it cover, general products that need to be repaired?
It depends on the state. And there was some pushback in New York because this bill did not specifically exclude agriculture. So that got us some pushback because they think that this is too broad. So in other states, what they've done is they've tried to limit the bill to a specific field. This one's only consumer electronics. This one's only medical. This one's only agriculture. And in different states, we're trying different approaches to kind of see which one works and if any of them get pushed forward. And something that was kind of sad over the past year is that in both Nebraska and Montana, you know, very farming heavy states, that they had agriculture only bills, so where they cut out the iPhone people and the medical people and the computer and the appliance people, and they said, we're just working on agriculture, and they were unable to get even that passed. And I'm really hoping that this changes it, because all of that not being able to get anywhere happened right before this report and executive order came out.
What have you guys, I'm just curious about this, just, you know, because you have a firm grasp on the strategy. What about going to a place where there's no agriculture lobby, where there's very little agriculture, and getting the farm bill, a farm equipment passed there, because there's less opposition, and then that place becomes, you know, I don't know what state that would be that has the least amount of agriculture, but that state ends up being the hub for buying tractor schematics and supplying with tractor parts.
I have never thought of that, but it's something to consider. I got to ask A about that.
Well, all right. Well, good. That would be great if that worked out.
I haven't
out.
Spent as much time on the agriculture side just because, like, I know little to nothing about it. I know a lot about my specific section of consumer electronics. With agriculture, you know, like, I've been to a farm once in my life.
I mean, it's just, it's amazing, because I think, like, you know, in those places where the need to right to repair is the most, one would imagine there's also the strongest lobby against it. But if there is a dynamic where certain states where, you know, once this information is available and the products are sold in one state, then you basically have let the cat out of the bag. I don't know. Maybe you go where there's as little need as possible. It becomes a very uncontroversial bill, but ends up making that state the hub of repairing for other states. I don't know if that works that way, but it's fascinating stuff. I'm curious, Has it expanded? Has it changed your politics, your perspective on politics at all more broadly? I mean, has, and I have no idea what your politics were before this, but has it, are you seeing, are you more conscious of monopolistic practices in other places, in other sectors of our economy?
I think it changed my politics in two ways. It didn't change. First thing I noticed is that left versus right matters a lot less than I thought it did, because I have been laughed, and I have it on film, laughed out of legislatures by both people on the left and the right. And I've had people on both the left and the right co-sponsor bills and say, I'm going to go to bat for you. I don't care if I'm sticking my neck out. It really seems to be a difference between politicians that listen to their constituents and politicians that listen to lobbyists. And I've noticed that distinction much more clearly. That's what matters. Are you someone where, as if some, you know, if a group of 10 people shows up to your office and explains something to you, you'll take the time to listen? Or are you only going to listen if they're showing up from CTA, Apple, or Google? That is a very clear distinction that I've noticed from the time that I've spent doing this. And in my YouTube comment section, I will see all the time the constant fighting between the two sides saying, of course, this is the side that's going to support it. No, that's the side that's going to support it. And in reality, I'll always have to remind them, that's not what it's about. You need to vote for someone that actually listens to you, that is open to like letting you in your office and letting you change their mind. And what I learned from it as well as that is that normal people, they actually have a bit more power than they think they do. They just don't use it because they're so cynical. And I don't blame people for being cynical, looking at the political landscape and how little things have changed in the direction people wanted to over the past 10 or 20 years. But when I could show up in an office completely unprepared, no script, never been to a legislature before, and get a legislator to just co-sponsor something that he was against it just before, that really changed it for me. It made me realize that normal people have a lot more say than they think they do if they actually start showing up. And it gave me a little bit of hope.
Well, that's great. How can people get involved in the Right to Repair movement, I guess?
What I tell people is cultural should come before legislative. So what I try to do on my channel, I try to get people excited about being able to fix something that they own, being able to either save money, make money for themselves if they run a repair business, or just get that, you know, nice kick of dopamine when they actually see the fan spin of the screen come on. Because once you have someone who's has that happy moment where the screen comes on after 2 hours of work, they'll be hooked and they'll support it. And for them to get other people in their lives involved. Legislatively, what they could do is you could go to a site like repair.org, see if there is a bill introduced in your state. If you put your address and your information in, it'll tell you who your legislators are. It'll tell you the bill numbers and let them know that this is something that matters to you. Give them a call. Give them an email. You know, more of them are open to listening than most people think. And it does make a difference.
What is the breakdown that you've come across? If you had to say percentage who are listening to corporate lobbyists versus the people who knock on their door, you know, their constituents, give me some percentages.
That's a tough one. That is a difficult one. I honestly wouldn't be able to say.
But all right,
I have to think about it and come up with that. So I would give something that's fair. But I will say that it does seem to be changing in the direction of less of them listening to the lobbyists. The thing here that's important is that it does, the American system when it comes to politics is set up for gridlock. It's very cautious. I would rather that, you know, nothing get done rather than something get done and it be bad. So it really doesn't take a large number of people listening to a corporate lobbyist for this to not pass. It only takes one or two people that, you know, to clog up the works at a particular area for nothing to get done. And that's what makes it so hard for us to get anything done, because we need to get such widespread support in such a short time period from so many different people. And there are times where, you know, this person is becoming the ambassador to Ireland, or that person is moving on to a new position. We've had times this year and also 3 years ago in New York where we actually do have a champion for our bill, and then they get promoted to another position, and then they get replaced, and then you have to start from scratch convincing right. The new person of everything. So,
Louis Rossman, real pleasure to talk to you. Owner, founder, Rossman Repair Group. And you can check out his YouTube page. We'll put a link to that in our podcast and YouTube description. Thank you so much for your time today, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap things up. We'll be right back. All right, folks, that's it for us today. If you're watching us on Peacock, if you're not, we're going to be talking to Sean McElwey about the Nina Turner race, get his perspective on this. But if you're watching us on Peacock, we will see you tomorrow. And if you're not, stick around. We're going to head into the fun half, and we're going to get a sense of what went on in Ohio, what the problem or problems were. It has been a tough couple of months for progressive candidates, we're gonna delve into that.
Dave Weigel had some good takes on his account, having followed the race. You know, basically saying that what were we gonna say?
Let's save it. Let's do it. Okay. in the fun half. We'll go in and we'll go through all of those. Just want to remind people that your support makes this show possible. When you become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, you support the free show, and you get the fun half. Oh, and we have a new announcement. Matt, can you pull up the AM Quickie newsletter?
Whoa.
Yes, very fancy. Ladies and gentlemen, we have developed the technology that allows us to take what we used to record in audio form and put it on paper, but it's not really paper. You can't, unless you print it out. It's actually...
Which you would do.
Which one could do. Mm. It allows us to email it to you. This is a technology that we have developed. And it allows us to email you these things. And here it is. It's the AM Quickie, the Majority Report. This is the first one that we've put out. I know people are going to be bummed. They want the old memo from the desk of Sam Cedar, format. Maybe we'll return that for a special one. But you can get this every day in your email box in the morning for free by signing up at majority.fm. I'll scroll all the way down to the bottom, and you just put your name in for our email newsletter. We're never going to sell your email address. You know, we're going to send these out in the morning, and we have really no intentions of, like, I don't know, then hitting your email ad box for, you know, like, oh, and hey guys, just checking in. And we may have other products, like email products that come from that, like whenever, I don't know what, but that's what it is for now. If you want this every morning in your inbox, do it. It's possible, late in the fall, we may do an audio product with it too. There may, who knows, but, we will always allow you the opportunity to, easily opt out if we do something like that. More often than not, it'll be opt-in, but this is you opting in to getting the new AM Quickie morning newsletter. Check it out.
Wow.
Sign up at majority.fm.
Wow.
You that's seem me really excited it by it, Emma. Really excited.
I'm having, yeah. Hump day.
What's that?
I don't know. Just move on.
Oh boy. Emma's really in a mood today. Don't forget, check out Nomi's show. It is Wednesday. That means that it's, youtube.com/TheNomiKeys Show. And, I don't know who's on it. She didn't know. So how would I know?
Right.
But check out Nomiki's show. Matt, what's happening, in Cedar versus, Cedar VCR repairman. Please restart the AM Quickie podcast for those of us who are too lazy to read. We may do.
Throw it in a text-to-speech program.
Clown show Mike, and we might actually do that. That's actually something I've considered. How is it possible at this point that I can't create a text-to-speech with me? I have thousands of hours.
You definitely could. It's just paying probably for the program that can take the inputs and do the conversion.
That is it, man. That's going to happen. I don't know when that's going to happen, but at one point, that's like, you're going to get the AM Quickie from me, and I'll be, long gone. 200 years from now, Sam Cedar brings you the AM Quickie. Four people are listening, but whatever. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian universe of media?
Ryan Pollack, IBEW member, is talking to David Griscom and I tonight, Left Reckoning at 8 Eastern, on getting union buy-in for climate action, particularly in Texas. And I'll also be discussing the new reporting on Tim Pool and his operation, also including how I'm trying to free his producer, I guess his name is Moonlord, who keeps trying to say, like, you know, things like basic reality, like, I don't want to get into it too much, but tonight we'll be talking to Tim Pool and sort of climate action. Left Reckoning, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the
Wait a second.
Game.
You want a free what?
Tim Pool has a producer who keeps trying to say, like, kind of things that are real. So, like, he said,
Right. I remember that. Like, he's trying to talk him off the ledge in terms of, the Holocaust with vaccines, or
it was the French Revolution recently, like, saying, well, what if the king's hoarding everything? And then he also did this thing where he said, you know, when I criticize Trump, our fans seem to have a real big problem with it. And Tim Pool immediately was like, no, I don't think that's the case at all. And so I just think, you know, stay strong, brother. We're both long hair boys now. And I'm going to try to save him from Tim Pool, because I think Tim Pool is.
I see what you're doing.
I think he's trying to exploit Moonlord. So
I love it. I love it. All right. That's great. All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 Back, boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a man.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can we bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Blast. Come on. Blast. Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.